My title tonight, Race and Ruination. We will get to why Exodus is crossed out at the end. But until then, let's begin. So Alonzo Leatherberry, there on the left, he's a man from Anaconda, Montana. He comes to the city in the 1890s with a company that is brought in to staff and work at the Montana Hotel. Very shortly after arriving, he rises up the ranks and becomes the head waiter at the hotel and the head steward, actually a fairly prominent position there. He is overseeing some 50 staff members and lives in a community with many other African Americans there in Montana. In 1912, he marries a woman named Josephine, and they live in Montana for about 8 more years, until at which point, for some reason, they sell their house and they leave, moving back to Kansas City, where he is originally from. At the time when he moves away, Alonzo Leatherberry is considered one of the most prominent members of Montana's African-American community, and even several newspapers have noted his stature within the entire Northwest. Down at the bottom, here's another person we're going to talk a little bit about tonight, Fred and Emily Harris and their son, Fred Jr. They move here to Bozeman around 1902. Fred Jr. is 2 years old at the time. They buy a house on South 4th. He works as a chef for the Gallatin County Club with his wife. For some time, they kind of switch in between jobs. Emily is working as a laundress, Fred as a porter for a local hotel, and then as a janitor for the Western Union Telegraph Company here in town. And in 1918, shortly after Emily's premature death, Fred and his son, Fred Jr., leave and move away in 1918 to Tacoma, Washington. The house above in this top right-hand corner is that of Jefferson and Louise Harrison. It is in Helena. Jefferson and Louise come to Helena, Montana in roughly around 1903 as part of the 24th Colored Infantry. Jefferson is the color sergeant for the D Company. He is the highest non-commissioned officer in the 24th Infantry. He fought in the Battle of San Juan Hill alongside and perhaps in front of Theodore Roosevelt's Rough Riders, who became so famous there. He fought in the First Philippines Campaign in 1901. After that, his company was stationed to Fort Harrison outside of Helena, where he bought his first house. He retired in 1906, but then reenlisted later that year to fight in the Second Philippines Campaign in 1907, after which retiring fully after 27 years in the U.S. Army. He worked for the Broadwater Hotel outside of Helena to the west, and then also as a waiter at the Montana Club downtown. He did this until about 1918 when he is laid off after nearly 2 decades in the city. He finds work temporarily as a watchman at Fort Harrison, where he had likely connections from his past life. But in 1922, Louise and Jefferson can no longer make ends meet, and they are forced to move away to Tacoma, Washington, 1922. I tell these three stories really quickly and without a lot of context because I want to pique something in the way that we think about the historic black community here in Montana. I want us to ask why were such prominent members of their community, ones that had managed to live here for decades, all of them owning homes, why is it they were all of a sudden, around the same period of time, forced to leave Montana, seemingly because of lack of work and the ability to make ends meet. So, in the history of African Americans in Montana in the West, in 1998, a very prominent historian wrote one of the larger historical surveys of the West. Dr. Quintard Taylor, who's now at the University of Washington, wrote about 300 pages on African Americans in the West, and about 2 of them were devoted to Montana, and told he also focused on the Helena community, where Jefferson Harrison was from. He focused about 2 paragraphs on them and 2 sentences on why the black community left. I'll read those to you because I think they're interesting to consider. So he said, by 1910, Helena's prosperous mining days had passed. The town's population declined by 500, but the African-American community shrank by half and fell sharply again in the 1920s. He is not wrong, and to all of Dr. Taylor's credit, he is not writing a history of Montana's black community. He is writing a history of African-Americans in the West, and his focus is largely on the West Coast and these urban centers. But contained inside his 2 sentences, about why the black community, and Helena in particular, declined, leaves a lot of questions that I'd like to answer tonight. I think that in so many ways you can do a history of African Americans in Montana, and you can focus in on numerous acts of personal racism and bigotry, and for certain tonight will not be a time where we can downplay those actions at all. But I'm more interested in kind of social issues. I feel like when you focus in on individual actions, you find ways in history kind of to retreat and find shelter away, kind of placing the blame on an individual. But tonight will be about the social structure which allows racism and social vulnerability in the black community to develop. And in that sense, I don't think we will find much refuge as we go through there. So to begin, I have one primary goal, and that is to convey that if we are to fully understand the exodus of Montana's historic black community, we cannot afford to think of the lives, the stories, and the history as other in the the lives and stories and history of black Montanans as other in the history of Montana in the West. Too often we anticipate the out-migration of the majority of black Montanans, and for that reason today we tend to cast that community in our cultural memory, in our mind, that they were just sojourners here in Montana. But in doing this, we segregate black history from Montana's history, and we dispossess the land of the many stories and experiences lived by black Montanans. So to understand why the black population fell so dramatically in the early 20th century, we must seek to understand the structural origins of social vulnerability. And to do this, I want to examine pieces of Montana's history by thinking through precarity. I like the word precarity because it is very direct in its definition, and I want to focus on three pieces of its definition here tonight. The historian Anna Lohaus Singh defines precarity as the condition of being vulnerable to others. Unable to rely on a stable structure of community, we are thrown into shifting assemblages, which remake ourselves as well as our others. We can't rely on the status quo. Everything is in flux, including our ability to survive. Thinking through precarity changes social analysis. A precarious world is a world without teleology. So in this definition, I want to point out some important things. First off is that precarity, if you think precariousness, it's the same word. She chooses to change it for her usage here, and I'll stick with that. That it creates and defines being vulnerable to others. So tonight we will look at stories and understand how society creates vulnerability. It also, she says, remakes ourselves as well as our others. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind because in this sense, we are not separated one community's history from another, that they cannot actually exist separately, and they must, and because they do affect one another, they remake each other. And finally, that this is a history without teleology. Teleology is a sense that historical events are inevitable, and they are bending towards some unchangeable outcome. The trouble with doing this, I think, in the history of African Americans in Montana, especially for our talk, is the idea that somehow this would have been inevitable. Because this has happened in the past, because the community dropped by so much, we tend to be, I think, tempted into thinking that whatever would have happened in the past, this would have been the outcome. I don't think we should think of that as the case. And instead, we can imagine other possibilities. Had things been different, had people acted in different ways, had structures been established through different processes, perhaps that this was not inevitable. So as some foregrounding, I know that a lot of people do not know this, but I will go through it really quickly. How does the African-American community even come to Montana in the first place, and what does that migration look like? Well, largely after emancipation in the 1860s and 1870s, we kind of discussed this time period in perhaps a period of arrivance in which much of the community that comes here is seeking refuge from the Civil War and kind of the trials of the country that is going on at that time. In the 1870s and 1880s, a steamboat line going up the Missouri to Fort Benton creates a large population of African Americans in Fort Benton and Great Falls. Railroads in the 1880s and 1890s, both bought by employing a large number of African Americans, as well as providing kind of more affordable travel out west, create large communities in Billings and Miles City in the 1890s. And then, of course, mining, smelting, logging, some of Montana's more popular and well-known industries at the time, kind of draw African Americans out west for work, if not in the mines or smelters themselves, in the communities supporting them, such as in Butte, Anaconda, Great Falls, Helena, and Missoula in some sense. And then finally, possibly, the most popular group that people hear about are the Buffalo Soldiers. From 1891, after the Pine Ridge Campaign in the Dakotas and eastern Montana, the African American regiments of the 24th and 9th Cavalry are stationed across Montana for several years, bolstering communities in nearby cities like Havre and Helena, especially Miles City and Fort Missoula. So the other thing that I want to stress about this community when it's first established was that even though it is small, in 1910 its highest number of population never exceeds around 2,000. Although because Montana's population is largely rural, about 60% in the early 1900s, the African-American population lives almost exclusively in about 7 or 8 cities. And even beyond that, they live very close together in many cases in tight-knit neighborhoods and work downtown. So I want to stress the fact that this is a very visible and engaged community. Here on the top, this is Anaconda from 1910 to 1930. This is about 5 or 6 blocks east of Main Street as you're coming into town on Commercial. The number of houses where people live and work is actually quite staggering if you know what's there in Anaconda today. In fact, I was saying to my parents earlier, that's likely more people than live there in that entire part of town at all. Here is Bozeman on its south side between 1910 and 1930. Again, a very kind of focused and prevalent community that members of these towns would not have missed in their daily going-ons. So it's also important to discuss the fact that when this population declines, that we're actually talking about more than just declining from perhaps Helena, from 425 African-Americans living in the city to around 118 by 1930, but in fact that of the total population in 1910, Helena's black population constitutes 3.4%, and by 1930 it drops to 1.1%. However, if you look at a place like Great Falls, where the population actually increases, the African-American population increases from 1910 to 1930, from 116 to 208, because of the growth of Great Falls as a community by itself, it still drops from 0.84% of the total population to 0.72%. So even in places where the black community grows, it is being kind of overwhelmed and subsumed by the white community at the same time. So we'll begin with the ways in which we find the social precarity that is affecting this community. So in the 1890s, a growing number of African Americans in Montana levied what small influence they had at the polls to advocate for more progressive candidates. Several black men were elected into office to serve as clerks or constables in the early 1890s with the support of a largely Republican and white electorate. Yet the decades that followed became increasingly contentious for African Americans interested in Montana's politics. Without a population large enough to successfully propel a candidate, white or black, into office, black Montanans were forced to find political fulfillment by incorporating social and racial politics, which they had loudly championed since arriving in the state, within local politics. I suggest that at nearly every turn, the mission to carve out a space for black Western politics was challenged and subverted by the prevailing political and social powers in early 20th century Montana. There's many ways to get at this history, and I think my favorite one is to tell the story of the Butte New Age, and then kind of go from there. The Butte New Age begins in Butte, Montana in 1901. It is started by two black barbers, Chris Dorsey and John Duncan. They advocate at the time that they no longer feel the need or the necessity to bind themselves to one political party. Nationally, African Americans are predominantly Republicans at this point, the party of Lincoln. This is decades before Nixon's Southern strategy switches the party's views on race and issues like that. So in Butte, they really were struggling with understanding where their place was within a community that was largely dominated by labor and labor politics. In Butte in general, we know of 3 men, for most part, here in Montana that controlled a lot of politics. Marcus Daly, the copper magnate from Anaconda, William Clark, the Butte mining, who owned most of the mines in Butte, and then a third lesser known Copper King Augustus Heinze. He also lived and worked in Butte. And these three men are important to understand the history of black politics in Butte. Marcus Daly at the time was aligned with the corporations of America. He had just joined his company, the Anaconda Company, with Amalgamated Copper, Standard Oil, and John D. Rockefeller, and was nationally a Democrat. His opponent, William Clark, positioned himself against him, kind of as a champion of smaller business and non-incorporation. And then Augustus Heinze, for the longest time, kind of joined with the Republicans on the national front to oppose Marcus Daly. However, in the early 1900s, things changed. Marcus Daly dies, for instance, and there is a power vacuum that opens up. And Augustus Heinze decides to switch and become a Democrat and align his business interests with the corporations. And one of these really interesting things that happens is that Chris Dorsey, the co-editor of this paper, happens to be one of Augustus Heinze's closest employees and confidants. He is his personal assistant and valet at the time. And this is precisely when these two men are trying to carve out a place in print for the black population's political goals, to advocate for their positions and for their interests. And all of a sudden, whereas John Duncan had remained largely Republican nationally, Chris Dorsey switches and becomes and starts advocating, at least locally, for Democratic politics. He's not the only person of African American person in Butte who does this. See down on the left, the Colored Democrats meeting suggests that a number of African Americans were Democrats, at least on a local aspect. One of the men at that meeting said that while I'm a Republican nationally, I must consider our interests and the benefits of our unions and our industries at a local level. And he says, benefits of our unions and our industries. However, this is strange considering the fact that African Americans are not allowed to work in the mines of Butte at this time and are banned for largely across the entire state from every union. Even later on, I'll include this piece here on the bottom right, a strict Republican, both locally and nationally, the editor of the Montana Plain Dealer, Joseph Bass, when things are not, he feels right with Republican politics, he is quick to criticize the governor of Montana and its Republican Senate for passing the 1909 anti-miscegenation law, which outlawed interracial marriage. So there is a lot of dissent in the political community. This dissent, though, actually kind of estranges Chris Dorsey and John Duncan from one another, and in their attempts to kind of forge a new place of political activism in Montana, they become kind of very chippy with one another. Chris Dorsey leaves the paper, and then John Duncan spends a good amount of time in that same paper criticizing Chris Dorsey and his Democratic politics, as well as everything that he does in his personal life. In 1902, Chris Dorsey leaves Butte, and of all the people who leave Montana in this talk tonight, he goes to probably the best place. He leaves and moves to Honolulu. Everyone else moves to Tacoma. I don't know. He had it right, I think. So as I mentioned, this issue of creating public space for African Americans in local politics was deeply flawed, and it was deeply flawed because it relied on allying with the labor unions, and they proved to be a very unwilling partner in this. This is from a piece written in 1909, as you can see the title up there, the timely article on labor issues. Joseph Bass wrote that the union secures better hours, better wages, and strives to raise the standard of workmanship. To all these benefits, the Negro is excluded. We know much of labor unions in the West. Out here, almost every form of labor is organized and then federated, and from these unions, we are restricted. So he points out the kind of the disconnection between trying to rely and force your political goals to work through labor when you're in fact excluded from labor. And I think this is one of the reasons that you create kind of political precarity in the life of black Montana by forcing all politics to be contending with the industries of the state, but at the same time excluding African Americans from the industries of the state. You take away their ability to act be active in a political sense. So, another place we can find this, as a someone who works for the the SHPO office, the State Historic Preservation Office. We care deeply about place and doing history through place. So I, this is one of the my very favorite stories I tell about African American populations in Montana, and it is a place-based history. So tangential to the politics of race in Montana is another important category that requires our attention. In many Western communities, the development of a strong place identity came to be a defining characteristic. Even today, Montanans retain deep roots to place and community, and this is often expressed by the number of generations their family has been there. Early on in the 19th and 20th centuries, this process was ongoing, and I would argue even more intense within the African-American community. Forming strong bonds of community between individuals and family along cultural lines occurred within this settler state of Montana, which prized place and land as the most important attribute. As was the case with much of the white community, Black Montanans sought to create cultural and social ties to the land through various places in Montana, and in many ways, these became sites of social belonging to the Black community. However, to the dominant white society, they were viewed as tangible evidence that the westward expansion, which had at the time had was seen and considered to be a white Anglo-American or European project, was in fact a far more complex and racially diverse than the predominant myth had proclaimed. We find the ways in which this history is played out, I think most clearly, on Clore Street, which is now South Park in Helena, Montana. They're kind of up against, the Clore Street runs up against Last Chance Gulch, near where Reader's Alley and the library are, if you have been there today. In 1903 to 1907 was a building called the Zanzibar. It was owned by a Black man named Lloyd Vernon Gray, who, among other things, worked and owned several shoe shining parlors, a tailor, what he called a suditorium, essentially a tailoring shop, and was also very active in the city's predominant prostitution ring. And he had a number of women who worked for him who were actually white and not just Black. In 1903, this piece ran, this is a cutout, here, that's what I meant to do, there on the bottom. This ran in several Eastern papers showing that Lloyd Vernon Gray had created a place for the entire African-American community and not just the more like rough and tumble place that Clore Street, with its many bars and brothels and different kind of establishments, had become famous for. They boasted reading rooms, dance halls, different social events. Even Joseph Bass, who was a very ardent prohibitionist at the time and advocated for the outlawing of alcohol, even found times and means in which he could come and use Gray's establishment. The Zanzibar Quartet, which he was the head of, practiced here. This ran several Eastern African American papers, and it talked about the promise that Gray had been able to show could be fulfilled in Montana if you had some hard work. And a little gumption and, you know, some initiative to do what you will. However, in 1906, at the end of 1906, the city administration decided that things needed to change with Clore Street and with the Zanzibar in particular. It happened that later that year, two prostitutes who had been known to work from time to time in places around the Zanzibar were involved in two separate murders in which they had actually killed some of their clients, raising the question of whether or not it was self-defense. The city administration, police chief Bailey, the city alderman of that district, Jake Lisner, and the mayor, Lindsay, who was a Republican at the time, decided that they needed to do something and to stop this, and they revoked the business license of the Zanzibar. Lloyd Vernon Gray obviously sued in court because there was no crime that was committed, and it was very quick to have this decision reversed in kind of a seeming victory of justice. But later on this year, in early 1907, Police Chief Bailey is standing outside the Zanzibar, and he watches a young man walk in and out and cites the Zanzibar for selling alcohol to minors. And in 1907, to cite someone was selling alcohol to minors truly is meant to be one of the most snide ways of getting your... I cannot stress how kind of inconsequential that might have been as a crime. But with proof of a crime in hand nonetheless, they closed the Zanzibar forever. Well, in 1981, historian William Lang, who was working at the Historical Society at the time in Helena, looked and found this story, and he wrote one of the best pieces on it. And he decided that in order to tell this story, he was delving into the character of Jake Lisner, who happened to own a bar only 3 blocks away and was, in fact, involved in prostitution in the same businesses that Gray was, and argued that Lisner was defending his business interests and was acting out of pure spiteful personal racism. And I actually agree wholeheartedly with William Lang in this sense. That is certainly what is going on. However, I feel like there is another dimension which gives us more of an understanding with this story. And it goes back to that point I made earlier, that the Zanzibar was seen not just within Helena to the black community, but all across the nation in different black papers as a point of opportunity and a place of significant community identity to the black population there in Helena. I think that if you remove this way of thinking through place from this story, if it is just a story of personal racism and a black man crossing the color line in 1907 Helena, you can remove it from Helena, and you might as well place it in any other part of the country, and it would be roughly the same and understandable and believable. But by placing it within the context of Helena's community at the time and the way the black community viewed this building as a sanctuary and a refuge for so many of their public and social actions, then I think you see another dimension. And then instead of being a racist action against one black man, the owner, we can understand this to be an attempt to undermine the stability and continuity of the entire black community there in Helena. Another place I think that we need to consider this is, and I brought it up earlier with the 1909 miscegenation law, is the domestic spheres. So the ability of any community to survive hard times often relies on certain factors. Among the most important were the stability of domestic life and the ability of that community to provide a social safety net to its members. In the West and in Montana, this was even more vital, as it was often the only barrier between individuals and utter ruin. Yet, as we shall see, laws which in the South were designed to maintain clear markers of racial difference between whites and the oppressed African Americans made a strange appearance in Montana. In 1909, when the population of the black community never exceeded more than 3% in any city, and where only a few dozen interracial marriages occurred in the state's short history, state lawmakers followed a wave of anti-miscegenation laws that swept the West and the northern parts of the country and outlawed interracial marriages between whites, blacks, and Asian Americans. While seemingly trivial, as it affected so few people, obviously, this was a legislation laden with peculiarities, and it clearly illustrated that the Western attitude towards race centered on issues of security and belonging rather than strict ideas of racial purity. And I say that, and I want to be very clear, this did not mean that there was no personal vendettas or racist beliefs that might have been on the part of lawmakers. But we can kind of get a unique way to look at this by understanding that the 1907 miscegenation law, which failed, failed in large part because it included Native Americans as part of this community as well. People who understand the concept of kind of blood quantum, I think, and the way in which smaller and smaller number amounts of Native blood entitles a person to smaller numbers of tribal lands or tribal protections might suggest that they excluded the Native clause in the second version of this bill precisely so that they can continue removing Natives' populations from the land through slow processes of marriage. At the same time, you also have a number of white men who are looking to marry into wealthier Native families who are land rich so that they too can kind of enjoy some of this property which they otherwise would not have access to. But I think another way to think about it is to kind of parallel the different ways that interracial marriage was seen. And the first story I want to tell is from 1890. It's in Helena, and here it's up on the upper left. It says, a colored professor wins the heart of a fair white maiden. In this sense, professor means a musician. He worked as a musician, and Z.A. Coleman worked as a musician and a waiter at the Metropolitan Hotel in Helena, where he met a woman the paper identifies as Mary Leonard. in the story that is put out in this paper in the Helena Independent in 1891, the story goes that they go to the Methodist minister late at night, and they provide a marriage certificate, and it lists both parties, or it lists both parties as black. When the minister looks at Mary Leonard and says, "You seem to me to be white," they argue, like, "Well, there are many black women who are lighter skinned than me," and he admits that that is in fact true, and they go ahead and perform the marriage ceremony. And at the end of this article, there is no call for violence necessarily. They do elevate and try to emphasize the way in which Z.A. Coleman is always well-dressed, and they try to emphasize the way in which he is shunned by his black community for only having white company around at times, and they debase Mary Leonard for not being able to read and write her own name and not knowing from where her family comes, essentially. And in this way, they try to equivalate and justify this interracial marriage. But it's very different than even different parts of the country in the 1890s, where such an event would have been seen in a completely different way, and it will be different from how it is viewed in the 1920s and 1930s in Montana. The interesting thing about this story is that it is, in fact, completely, or not completely, but mostly fabricated. The actual marriage license of Z.A. Coleman and Mary Loughlin, not Leonard, show that Mary Loughlin is, in fact, listed as white on their marriage license. It is digitalized, and I found it on Ancestry.com. Little did they know that they would be caught 100-and-something years later. Not only that, but the white minister signs it, and his entire family are their witnesses. His son, it takes place in their home, and they certainly would have known with a woman's name like Loughlin here in Montana, there is no way you are anything but Irish, and it is very unlikely that you are black in that case. So the claim of the newspaper is surely to try to dissuade the people of Helena from being upset about this and to calm and justify the marriage in whatever possible way. Well, things change between 1891 and 1909. Across the country, anti-miscegenation laws are passed largely with a growing eugenics movement, and there is an emphasis on maintaining white racial purity. At the time, Senator Muffley from Broadwater passes the bill after removing the prohibition on white and native marriages, and it passes. However, throughout the next few decades, the implications of this might be difficult to find. So I'd like to kind of remind us now of one of those men that we talked about in the beginning, in fact, the young boy, Fred Jr. When he moves to Tacoma, Washington in 1918, the very next census here in Bozeman, 1920, shows that there is not a single person living in Bozeman who Fred Jr. could have legally married. I have imagined this several times looking back, is we can say that, you know, socially it was not acceptable, or socially many African-American men and women did marry white Montanans, but I feel like that we are cutting ourselves off from being able to recognize what this really would have meant for Fred Jr. Fred Jr. died 7 years later, mysteriously, in Tacoma. So coming to my final point of the evening, I want to reiterate this central thesis, that to understand the realities of this outmigration, it will necessarily require us it will necessarily require us to consider what I like to call the entanglements of race and region. So how do we reorient the collective memory of Montana's history to include these fraught racial dynamics, as well as the lived experiences of African Americans, indigenous peoples, Latinos, migrant Chinese workers, and other Asian Americans as well? Serendipity seems to have had something to say about this in my research, and it is now the 100-year anniversary of the 1917 drought, which crippled the Homestead Act, or the homesteads which once dotted the state. The homestead boom was one of the widest social movements ongoing in the region. Yet upon its crash in the late 19-teens and early 20s, this disaster in many ways was most damaging to the black community, a group that perhaps participated the least in this phenomenon. So in order to understand and tell this story, the idea that I want to examine the entanglements of race and region, I think it's important to recognize how we build a historical memory of ourselves as Montanans or as Westerners or whatever it is you are from. In many of these ways, I have found that people in Montana often pick an event or a movement, and they identify strongly with that movement. For myself, growing up in a small town, even though my family was not from there, I understood ethnicity and labor unions and mining to be somewhat important in my past. If you were from Shodo, perhaps, then homesteading would have been what tied you to this region historically and kind of helped to create a memory and an understanding of yourself in this place. Well, to tell how that is entangled with the issue of race and racism in Montana, I'd like to begin with someone who would not be naturally a candidate to explore. Sven Bausti was born in 1892 in Drammen, Norway. In 1909, he boards a boat and lands in Ellis Island. In 1916, this young Norwegian man is naturalized and immediately applies for a homestead patent in Shodo County, Montana. The next year, he proves up on his 160 acres in 1917, and then he becomes one of the more unlucky people in Montana. That same year, the rains pretty much stop falling from Montana's big sky. It is one of the hottest winters with very little snow. The next spring in 1918 is also very hot and with very little rain. The summer, even hotter. Over the next 4 or 5 years, tens of thousands of homesteads cross Montana, especially up in the High Line and the eastern part of the state, fail. Sven Bausti's homestead fails in 1922, and he moves to the largest city in the area, Great Falls, where he finds employment at the Park Hotel downtown as a porter carrying bags. We know this is his application for a passport in 1924 in which he lists his occupation and where he lives and where he works. However, I think it's important to consider some of the people we talked about at the very beginning. Alonzo Leatherberry, who was laid off from a hotel for some reason in around 1918. Same with Fred Wilson, at least works at a hotel for a while, but does not keep that job. Same thing with Jefferson Harrison, the Buffalo soldier, the retired sergeant living there in Helena. He worked at a hotel and a club and is laid off in 1918. So I think we need to ask ourselves, does Sven Bausti and the 25% of homesteaders who lose their land and then come to a city to find work in the service sector, should we consider them to have taken the jobs in many of these professions in which African Americans had relied for decades and decades in Montana? I'm not exactly sure if that's the way we need to think about it. Rather, I think we need to consider the fact that when Sven Bausti showed up to the Park Hotel in Great Falls as a Norwegian man in his ideal Scandinavian whiteness, his position in society as a white man was preferable over Jefferson Harrison, who had served 27 years in the U.S. military. It is not that one man replaced the other, but it shows us a glimpse that the society in Montana at the time privileged Sven Bausti and his whiteness over Jefferson Harrison and his blackness. Abstractly across the West, this event, by historians, is often called the whitening of the West. And I'll talk about these pictures here, kind of illustrate this. Well, first, in 1890 or so, Montana and the West is an incredibly diverse place. 1890 in Montana, with only North Dakota kind of neck and neck, it is the most diverse place in America. A larger percentage of its citizens are born outside the United States than any other place in the country. That does not include the large Chinese population, the large Japanese population who are not citizens. That does not include the large population of Slavs and Italians and other Eastern Europeans who might not have been considered white, who were citizens and had been born in this country. And that does not include the 2,000 or so African Americans that lived across the state. So it does give you a sense of how diverse the West was. Today, Montana is the least black state in the nation. both by the total number and the percentage of its population. This event, which is how historians have understood it, was called the Whitening of the West. Here in 1908, on the top left, is a famous picture by Montana artist Charlie Russell. It is of York, Clark's enslaved body servant, at the Mandan village in the Dakotas. And he is showing the scene in which the Corpse of Discovery's journals mentioned that the Mandans came up and were interested by York's skin and tried to rub to see if the black would rub off. The very first black man to enter the Western United States, I found it interesting that some 100 years later, the only picture that Charlie Russell paints of an African American, he is trying to be cleaned. Below, if you might guess what this is a young white boy in black makeup or black face. And if you can guess from the streamers, he is sitting in the back of a cast iron tub washing himself in the middle of a parade. This is Havre, Montana in 1924 in their Elks Parade. The parallels between these two pictures I find really, really interesting. But they get at this idea that maybe the whitening of the West was not this singular event. And if you think through all the times tonight which we talked about creating social precarity, that in fact maybe this is not an event at all, but rather a deliberate social structure with a concrete goal. So, in conclusion, you will also notice that at the beginning of the talk I had crossed out Exodus. And I will talk about that right now, and I think it connects. I believe that there is a severely underrated value in being precise in what we name things. Regardless of how well people may understand, misnaming something can have consequences. And I chose the word Exodus tonight, not to describe tonight's talk, not because I think it is the best word, but because it is one which we have always and most readily associated with this event, the loss of the black community. In fact, I think it is quite the wrong word to use. But I want instead to examine what I see to be the implications of using Exodus to describe the outmigration of the black community in the early 20th century from the perspective of Montanans living here today. Exodus has a long history for African Americans. From its biblical roots, black Americans have consistently understood the oppression of slavery to have parallels with the ancient Israelites. Harriet Tubman, who led thousands from slavery along the Underground Railroad, was known by many as the Moses of her people. The first great migration of freed African Americans from the South in the 1870s to Kansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri was known as the movement of the Exodusters, those who made an exodus. Exodus suggests that a group has fled oppression and enslavement. Inherent in the word is the notion of escape. But the black community in Montana was not escaping. Also inherent in the word and the idea that someone would exodus a place is that they did not belong in the land that they were leaving. An exodus implies that the promised land, their home, is elsewhere. This is the thought that I would like to leave you with tonight. I believe that to use exodus to describe the loss of the black community is more than merely anachronistic. I think that it shows the lingering and sedimentary effects of society's racism, or what I call ruination. The same social structure which created the precarity which we have spent tonight exploring continues to inform the way which we conceive of ourselves as Montanans and even Westerners. The instinctual reaction of the white Montanans and historians alike to use Exodus in this way illustrates, even in a small sense, how we continue to see the black community as interesting, engaging, and unique, but not necessarily as Western, and not necessarily as Montana's history. If there was an exodus from Montana, then the black community was only ever sojourners here in the first place. But this is not the case. Rather, I suggest that we take care to call this history for what it is. A process of exclusion. And finally, in understanding the exclusion of the African Americans in this way, I think we should not consider that black history in Montana to be a story of a people who lived vibrant but closed communities, shut off from the rest of the state. Instead, we should see the lives of Jefferson Harrison and Sven Bousty to be intertwined and fused. We should recognize that Sven Bausi's story, as well as our own in many ways, cannot be separate from the racial ruination that sought to remove the black community, and it is all part of the complicated racial history that in so many ways has defined Montana. Thank you.